Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here. And more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The global AIDS epidemic threatens more than just the health of millions of individuals. AIDS is now destabilizing entire countries and regions. Strategists are now describing AIDS as a global security threat, a menace to economics, to economies, to social order, to the existence of states themselves. Empty fields, dying police, sick militaries. In AIDS-ridden Africa, societies are coming undone. Economic development is at a standstill, and political unrest is mounting. Yet the crisis is far from over. At the 2002 International AIDS Conference in Barcelona, which began today, scientists report that the epidemic has not peaked. It's projected that by 2010, there will be more than 45 million new infections. The average life expectancy in some African countries has dropped nearly in half. Parents are vanishing. In 8 years, the number of AIDS orphans in Africa will triple to 42 million. Early today, I spoke with Dr. Richard Marlink, executive director of the Harvard's AIDS Institute, who was at the conference in Barcelona. I asked him to describe the most pressing news coming out of this year's conference.
Here in Barcelona, I think we're waiting for the rest of the world to live up to the promises that have happened really in the last year with the United Nations General Assembly special session on AIDS, which occurred last June, where 180 countries signed a commitment to step up to the plate against AIDS. We're all wondering, will these promises be kept? Are the countries that are the haves of the world going to help the have-nots?
What are the trend lines in AIDS prevalence that ought to be getting the attention of those countries?
I think throughout the 20-plus year history of this epidemic, we've repeatedly underestimated this virus, unfortunately. As we know, in the art of war, you never underestimate your enemy, but we've repeatedly done that, and the projections now show again that we're going to be faced with death and destruction that we have not calculated just within the next decade. So we're still looking towards Africa, and especially Southern Africa, as the unfortunate ground zero right now. But each of the other areas worsening still in Asia, the subcontinent of India, et cetera. So the word is a broken record, as it were, here at the conference in terms of the trends in epidemiology and of the virus moving around the world. The wake-up call of Durban, which was 2 years ago, the International AIDS Conference in Durban, was perhaps an attention to the problem in Africa. And now, in Barcelona, the call is, okay, we've all made promises since that conference 2 years ago in Southern Africa. Are we going to follow through? Are we as a global community going to follow through on those promises?
I think there's a sense in the United States that somehow the epidemic has stabilized. But as you describe it, globally, this epidemic in some sense is just beginning.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, in sort of scientific terms, we're just starting our dance with this virus, the dance with this devil, so to speak. We're really starting to learn how this is going to affect humankind more than the Black Plague of 600 years ago. This is the plague, and how we respond to this plague will really determine parts of human history. We really need to live up to the promises of trying to confront this epidemic with major funding and major effort on a global scale.
What is the perspective from Barcelona on how this epidemic may affect humankind over the next 10, 20, 50 years?
The problem with when you have one out of four or one out of three people walking down the street, listening to this conversation, working in your office, in your family, infected with HIV, right now that level exists in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, South Africa itself has the highest sheer numbers of people living with HIV, although it's a larger country. But the percentages of people in Southern Africa living with this virus are 1 in 4 in general, and some populations, younger sexually active populations, even higher.
If all the money were put on the table as promised and the manpower, could this epidemic be addressed?
Yes, I think you put it in two terms, the money and the manpower. The money is needed, but also the work, the people power to improve the healthcare systems that don't exist in many parts of the world, especially in Africa. We have treatment that puts people back to work. I mean, antiretroviral drugs work. They're not a solution. They're not a cure.
Are they even a reasonable way of approaching the problem in Southern Africa, where the problem is so widespread and these drugs are so expensive?
Well, cost is still a problem. Cost has come down. Pharmaceutical companies have done a dramatic difference in terms of bringing costs down and try to make it essentially a non-profit exercise for them. Many pilot programs throughout the world now are showing, and that's what's been showing here in Barcelona, that it is possible to safely give these relatively expensive and relatively toxic and chronic drugs, but we can give them over time. And it's really a tragedy when you have only about 30,000 people outside of North Americans and Europeans and industrialized countries, only about 30,000 of the 28 to 29 million people infected with this virus worldwide that are on these therapies, compared to 500,000 or so in the United States alone that are on the therapies.
So we see the therapies very far from being everywhere that it might be. The UN AIDS report estimates it will take about $9.2 billion a year to reverse the disease. Currently, I think the global community is only contributing about 7% of that sum. How close are we to doing even the minimum required to keep this from being a global destabilizing disease?
Well, I think it already is. The point of Barcelona here is that we're not just waving a flag and raising the alarm. This is already destabilizing in places that can't afford to be destabilized, such as Zimbabwe or other conflict-ridden areas where one quarter of the teachers in certain places have died of AIDS already, professionals, workers. It's already among us, and we have to step up to the plate and live up to the promises of increased resources. The history books will really look back and determine how we responded to this.
Richard Marling, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard Marling is executive director of the Harvard AIDS Institute. He spoke with me earlier today from Barcelona. The AIDS epidemic is now beginning to threaten the stability of entire nations, and the outlook is getting more grim. Political anarchy, social breakdown, and economic ruin are all part of the new emerging reality of the AIDS crisis. How real is the global threat of AIDS to you? What needs to change to reverse the path of destruction? And are you willing to make the investment? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Morrison. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Morrison.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Stephen Morrison, we just heard from Richard Marling at Harvard's AIDS Institute, and all the word coming out of Barcelona is this thing is just cranking up and it's going to get much bigger before it turns a corner, if it turns a corner. Give us a sense of what it's beginning to mean in material terms to African countries. What is the threat to infrastructure, economics, societies as the disease gets larger?
Well, we're seeing a flood of evidence coming forward from a diversity of sources right now out of southern and eastern Africa. Analysts, for instance, out of the University of Natal, who've been examining impact on teaching cores in KwaZulu-Natal and other parts of southern Africa, are showing collapse of elementary and secondary school systems. Reports coming out of places like Botswana are showing that your health sector workers are, in fact, sick at a fairly high rate and fatigued and overwhelmed by this, and those who are healthy and able to move are actually taking opportunities to move elsewhere. In places like Zambia, we've seen studies of the impact on the financial sector, upon the finance ministry, which was built up over the years with considerable investments from the United States and elsewhere in building talent. Many of those talented individuals have gotten sick and passed away. The institution is financial management or decaying. We're also seeing very heavy stresses on policing as the orphan population skyrockets in urban and peri-urban settings. These are populations that are marginal, desperate, very unhealthy, pretty much stripped of any ties to support networks.
So they're not a stabilizing force in their countries, to say the least.
No, quite the contrary. This is, we're at the front edge of this particular problem. There's an estimated 11 to 13 million orphans already created by AIDS within Africa. And we see huge populations. A city like Lusaka has 100,000 orphans that didn't exist 5-6 years ago. And this is just the front edge. How we cope with that is going to be a critical challenge. On the economic front, you now have in southern Africa a very severe drought and risk of famine concentrated in places like Zimbabwe, Malawi, Zambia.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the analyses of the roots of that drought and risk of famine point to bad weather, bad governance, and the impact of HIV/AIDS on rural household production, because farmers are getting sick, families tend to sell off their assets, production levels drop, and this is a long-term structural problem of deficits in food production.
Stephen Morrison, what happens, looking back at history or even at the contemporary evidence from African countries, when whole countries begin to lose infrastructure, teachers, police, military, farmers? What does that mean for countries? Do they simply float down to a different, even lower level of economic existence and go on, or do they somehow come unraveled in a more profound way?
Well, we don't know the answer yet to that question because we haven't seen this pandemic play itself out into the next chapters. But this is a point of active debate among leaders within Southern and Eastern Africa, those who have begun to really come to terms with this. Some, like President Mahai in Botswana and his Minister of Health, Joy Pumapi, fully recognize the threat that this poses and are describing it as a strategic threat to society and the nation state as they know it.
Botswana, where the average lifespan has dropped from 62 to 37 already and is projected to go down further.
Correct. And this is a place that is a functioning democracy, has reasonably coherent bureaucratic structures and is well endowed materially. So, and is making a major investment to try and turn this around, but is fighting against continued rising rates of infection.
Is it possible that whole countries will disappear, that they'll be swallowed up by larger or healthier neighbors?
Well, that's a bit of a reach right now. We know that within Africa as well as within the wider world, there's great resistance to doing away with sovereign entities as we know them, even the weakest of them.
But if they're gutted, hollowed out, they might fall of their own accord at some point.
That's quite possible. We could see that. We could see that. The bigger question right now is whether or not the very heavily populated states within Africa, which are really the anchors for security within the continent, South Africa, Ethiopia, Nigeria, whether they will be able to cope. And there's some recent promising news in South Africa in the sense that dating back to mid-April, the government began to correct its course and show some determination and leadership in moving forward. In Nigeria, President Obasanjo has gotten way out in front in the Abuja conference a year ago, April, in getting ministers from across the continent to pledge that they would move to substantial increases in their budgetary commitments on health sectors.
But Africa needs those anchor countries in order to carry on. Jack Beattie, can you imagine, here we are 20 years on in the AIDS crisis, and it's no longer a matter of private fear, it's a matter of state, of the function of whole states potentially coming undone.
Yeah, listening to Stephen Morrison outline that really fairly apocalyptic picture of just all these services decaying And the economy, of course, each sick person subtracts from the economy. Productivity goes down. Spending has to go up. But just at that time, the economy is shrinking, so there's less money to spend, which means there's less care, which means the economy deteriorates further. I mean, the cycle sounds just almost hopeless.
We're talking tonight about the AIDS impact, maybe the AIDS anarchy, beyond the simple numbers, how AIDS is eating into countries around the world. Will the AIDS wildfire destroy Africa? Will the West stand by and watch it happen? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the AIDS impact, maybe the coming AIDS anarchy. What do you think? Will the United States be exempt as nations fail, as continents potentially implode? Are we financially and morally prepared to address a health apocalypse? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Stephen Morrison. He's the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And we're joined now by Catherine Riley. She's a political economist. She's advised three African presidents and currently consults with the United Nations on HIV/AIDS. Good evening and welcome, Catherine Riley.
Good evening, Tom.
Catherine, you looked specifically at how the AIDS pandemic hits women in Africa and beyond. We often think of women as a stabilizing factor in many societies. Why does AIDS fall especially heavily on women, and what's the impact of that in countries where AIDS is very heavily prevalent?
Good question, and it's important for us to look at this as we've been talking about the unraveling of states. We need to remember that states are made up of men and women, mm-hmm. families and communities. We've seen throughout Africa that gender inequality has actually put women at high risk of AIDS and actually has been killing them at higher rates. Specifically, the big news out of Barcelona is that girls are dying first. We see that the prevalence rates of HIV among girls aged 15 to 24 is 3 to 4 times that of men.
That's huge. What's driving that?
What's happening is intergenerational sex, or the what people are calling the sugar daddy phenomenon, where girls are forced to engage in survival sex.
That means sex for food or money or means to live.
Exactly. Sex for survival, sex for a good meal, sex for food for their children, or if they're lucky enough, a week's school fees.
So you're saying that infected older men are reaching down into a younger generation of women and even girls for sex, and therefore you've got much heavier HIV infection in that tier.
Precisely, and sadly, in countries like Zimbabwe, where there's been massive denial on the part of the government, myths abound about the causes of HIV and its methods of transmission. And one of the cruelest myths is that men can actually pass on HIV and rid themselves of HIV by sleeping with a virgin.
You mean they give it to the virgin, but they're freed from it?
Exactly. Zero-sum game. So the consequence, sadly, is that there are 230,000 Zimbabwean children under the age of 15 who are infected, most of whom are girls.
What is the, I mean, it's a tragedy just all in itself. What is the impact on a society for a whole generation of young women to be so deeply infected with AIDS?
The impact is that Africa will lose its mothers. You've already cited the terrifying statistics of the number of orphans, and it will get worse as more and more young women are dying.
If a country doesn't have its mothers, it will still have mothers. It will have fewer. I guess that this means there'll be an imbalance of genders, more men than women.
Exactly. You'll have older men and younger women if the trend continues as it does.
And that means men without mates or without wives.
Exactly.
Which would look like a destabilizing factor in itself.
Exactly.
Stephen Morrison, how do you see this gender picture factoring into the political stability environment in Africa?
Well, I think Catherine has said it very, very well. The powerlessness of women and girls in Africa is a central factor in understanding how this pandemic has raced ahead of everyone in Eastern and Southern Africa, and until measures are taken to protect and empower women to control their sexual lives, this will not be arrested.
But that seems like a challenge all out of proportion to the speed of the of AIDS infection. I mean, you're talking about a culture that's grown up over centuries, and here AIDS is traveling at light speed in each decade. How do you change the culture in time to make a difference? Catherine Riley.
I'd like to come in there and cite the example of Uganda,
okay.
where, as we know, the AIDS prevalence has been cut by half mm-hmm. in the past decade.
How'd they do it?
Well, I would call it Museveni's political cocktail.
That's this President Museveni. Mm-hmm.
Museveni, who's used what I would call democratic triple therapy, where he started with involving civil society on a massive scale, which included religious leaders, women, youth, the mm-hmm. government, and most importantly, people living with AIDS. Number two, gender empowerment was at the center of his AIDS policy. That included economic empowerment. His poverty alleviation programs were targeted at women. Universal girls' education was at the center of the program.
Stephen Morrison, is the program that worked in Uganda one that you can imagine working in other parts of Africa, or is there something unique about Uganda that made it open to this, or could others adopt it as well?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the Ugandan model, and it's been used as a way of trying to coax leaders in other acutely affected countries to show leadership and to begin to reach out to these key sectors that Catherine identifies.
Is it working? Are they adopting it?
Some countries are beginning to move that way. You see some evidence in Kenya, in Zambia. You see certainly within South Africa, now that you have somewhat of a rectification of policies, you have a very strong civil society within South Africa that's quite mobilized, and you have a very sophisticated biomedical and public health community that's largely private.
Mm. Jack Beattie, here in the United States, there's a sense, I think, that's grown up right alongside the new drugs for treatment of AIDS, of a certain kind of exemption from this, that this is a disease that lives in the third world and at the margins of American society, and most people aren't worried about it. But here we're talking about the AIDS potentially wrecking a whole continent, maybe more.
Yes, and Americans, there's an increasing distance from it. I read today that the incidence in America is now concentrated and growing among African Americans. So white Americans seem to, it's even further removed from the experience of many people. And that is the real challenge, isn't it? How do you make, how do you even ethically respond to a kind of creeping Holocaust like this? And it seems to me that that's why governments are invented. They're supposed to respond and respond collectively. And yet when you look at the appropriations, they say $10 billion is needed a year. We're $9 billion short this year. Mm. We'll be $9 billion short next year. Well, I mean, what is the consequence of that? It just cries out for someone to say, well, Americans, would you pay an AIDS tax? Would you pay, $30 a head?
To keep Africans and others from being infected.
Yes.
Or to treat them when they are.
Right. Or even on our tax forms or something. But I don't think we're going to hear that from this administration.
Stephen Morrison, there's obviously a moral lever that could be applied here. But Americans are famously pragmatic. Is there a practical impact on the United States of AIDS destabilization around the world?
Not immediately. However, I want to emphasize that the data that's coming in on opinion surveys mm-hmm. in the United States among informed voters as well as foreign policy elites shows a dramatic shift
in the last
3 to 4 years towards a very heightened awareness and very heightened concern about what this means. It cuts across political parties.
It has not, we note, translated into more than that billion so far. I mean,
but let's put that billion in perspective. The U.S. government is putting over $1 billion this year mm-hmm. into international global programs out of a budget that's just under $15 billion. That represents a sixfold increase over 3 years ago.
That's a pretty big step.
There is a trajectory mm-hmm. of increases that is very, very sharp. It still falls as Jack pointed out, it still falls way short of what the requirement is.
Can you imagine the threat of political and economic destabilization being put in terms so acute that American voters would say, as Jack suggests, yes, I want to put more money toward this because if I don't, X, Y, and Z is going to happen to me or my children?
I think we're already moving in that direction. What you see in Congress is strong, welling, bipartisan support for much greater engagement and commitment of resources. We're in a very tight budget situation right now, obviously. But when Powell has stepped forward, Secretary Powell has stepped forward, when President Bush has stepped forward, the response in terms of heightened commitments has been very positive across the board. More leadership is needed. Higher levels are needed, but I think the door is open for leadership within this administration or the next administration to the level that's needed.
You may see those statistics, those polls, and I don't doubt them. At the same time, I sense a feeling out there that this AIDS is across the ocean. It's in Africa. It'll burn itself out one way or the other, and it's not really our problem. Can Americans afford, practically speaking, never mind the moral aspect, which is huge, but practically speaking, to take that attitude?
Let's look at it, you know, from a number of different angles. One is post-September 11th, there's much greater sensitivity to the notion that collapsing states, despair, and worsening poverty is not in U.S. national interest. Mm. And that argument has been used quite effectively by advocates of much heightened support for international global AIDS programs.
So that one day's events and all the thinking afterward may alert people to the problem and what might be done. Simon's on the line. Simon, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to pick up on that point, actually.
Good.
That as you see a society in which kids have not much future to look forward to, in which they don't have role models, in which there's no police, no military, that looks a lot like Afghanistan pre-September 11th.
Hmm.
And it looks like a society in which there's going to be anger at the U.S. for not doing more, a sense of hopelessness, a sense of outrage, despair. Looks a lot like a society that could be a breeding ground for terrorism.
So to Stephen Morrison's point, then, is when you might agree with, Simon, that this could create more enemies of the U.S. if it's not treated.
Right, that if we're going to be creating a Homeland Security Department, I think the war on AIDS should be part of the war on terrorism, and that would be a very smart investment.
Well, there's a big tent approach. Catherine Riley, let me put that to you. You pay a lot of attention to these things. Do you hear anger specifically directed at the United States because of the AIDS situation? Somehow, is there a connection made in Africa? Are people blaming this somehow on the United States?
People are aware of the huge inequities between the way Americans live and the way Africans live. Television, CNN, has come to African villages.
Mm-hmm.
Villages, there'll be one television that people will watch like a movie at a movie theater. And they're aware of the huge differences in our access to resources. And there's a resentment at that. And HIV just exacerbates the poverty that they're suffering. So, yes, there is an association between our wealth and their poverty and their suffering.
Simon, thank you for your call. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
One more ghoulish aspect to this is as birth rates decline in Western developed countries,
yes,
and the number of elderly citizens increases, I'd like your guest to talk about the ramifications on the medical infrastructure in these countries as you have a medical professional drain going on.
Well,
I recall listening to a program
mm-hmm.
on the BBC where they discussed just that issue, where there was a change in the policy with regard to bringing especially nursing. That's the big issue.
David, let me be sure I understand. Are you saying that the Western medical staff that might have been used in Africa and elsewhere won't be there because Western populations are aging? Is that your view?
No, actually, it would be Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, the subcontinent.
So their own indigenous.
Correct. They're coming from those countries to the United States, to Great Britain,
oh,
to Germany.
I got it. In other words, we're pulling off resources. We're drawing resources into the United States to care for an aging population that might be put to the front lines of the AIDS epidemic.
Exactly. And I don't – so even if we can pump the needed money, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, I guess I would agree with Mr. Beatty on that issue. The specter of Senator Helms still looms largely on mm-hmm. this in a foreign policy, because mm-hmm. I remember reading several years ago a CIA excerpts of a CIA white paper on just this issue, and they talked about this being a major national security issue for the 21st century. Mm. And it was largely ignored by the press. Mm.
David, thank you for your call. Stephen Morrison, there's a couple of questions there. First, on the availability of health workers in Africa and other countries where AIDS is mounting. You already noted earlier in the hour the losses they've already seen. Under what circumstances will they be able to keep up with the demand for medical treatment?
Well, we don't yet see in the acutely affected countries fully worked out strategies for training up and holding the sort of personnel that are required. On the one hand, the existing health infrastructure is under siege. People are getting sick. The staff are getting overwhelmed. You have active recruitment programs from Europe, North America, Australia, and elsewhere.
As our caller David alludes to, pulling talent to the first world.
Right. So you've got to, first of all, figure out a way to stabilize those existing infrastructures, to convince those people that they can live reasonably well and that they need to stay. I mean, it's not a question that you're going to forbid people the right to immigrate towards better economic opportunities.
But it must get awfully hard to convince them it's going to be a great place to stay when it's coming apart at the seams.
Right. It's a huge task. Mm-hmm. The other piece is there has to be a massive investment in new training, and that is going to involve a significant transfer of skills and technology out of North America and Europe, and that's going to require putting, for a very long time, new training facilities in place, along with personnel drawn from the West. So, into those settings, and we don't yet see the kind of training schemes that are up to the task.
So this is why you say it's not just a matter of allotting more money. You actually have to send people with the appropriate skills into these areas from the West.
Correct.
That sounds like a long path. David, thank you for your call. Catherine Riley, I want to get your gender perspective in here. As attention gets cranked up in Barcelona and elsewhere, do you see governments abroad and in Africa and AIDS-infected countries looking at this in gender terms, acknowledging the gender challenge here and stepping up to protect women, make them perhaps a bulwark against AIDS?
They are, and the African political leadership is most important in encouraging their peers to step up to the plate. The new Economic Partnership for African Development was just announced by four African heads of state in Canada last month, and this partnership emphasizes the importance of accountability among African leaders. That is to say, African leaders need to keep their fellow presidents and prime ministers accountable for a set of democratic principles that includes health care for all. And you have a core of democratic leadership who are committed to enforcing this and have specifically included access to health care and women's rights as a part of their definition of democracy.
It sounds like bolstering women is going to be absolutely critical. Catherine Riley, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Catherine Riley is doing a study currently with Boston University's School of Public Health for the UN on women's vulnerability to HIV/AIDS. We're talking about the AIDS impact, maybe the coming AIDS anarchy. Are we financially and morally prepared to address a health apocalypse? Do you believe the dire warnings? Do you believe whole nations may implode? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the real-world impact of AIDS, maybe the AIDS anarchy. What is the cost to the global economy, to the global soul, of watching whole nations collapse from AIDS? And are you at grips with the reality of living in the time of the new Black Death, of a new global plague? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Stephen Morrison. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And now from Madison, Wisconsin, by Matt. Welcome, Matt. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing tonight, guys?
Well, thanks.
The major problem that I have with all of the discussion here is it seems like we're focusing more on treatment instead of control. And I think that we have to take the approach that this epidemic, tuberculosis, was, you know, back in the early days before there was a cure for it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we approach it as a standpoint of we need to stop the infection. It's nice to be able to keep treating the people, but if we don't stop the infection, it's like throwing water on a grease fire. It's just going to spread.
Well, I think no one would argue with that. Catherine Riley was saying earlier that what she's longing for is to see cultural norms change so that women aren't so vulnerable. That, I guess, would be one factor, Matt, wouldn't it?
And yes, and I think that we have to tie that to any aid that we provide to those countries as a condition of receiving the aid. You know, if we go in, we have to dictate certain cultural norms, and if they don't want to change those norms, then the amount of impact is, or the amount of financial responsibility, mm-hmm. I think we should have, from a Western point of view, should be very low. If they're not willing to commit to changing their culture to save it, then the culture is going to ultimately die no matter how much money we throw at it.
Well, there's a tall order. We got it. Matt, thank you for your call. Stephen Morrison, give us your feedback to that. You've looked a lot at this. Matt says if they don't change culturally, then never mind the aid. It won't do any good. Can we afford to, to say no help for you until you change your culture, or do we have to go in with both guns blazing?
Well, first of all, the question of prevention versus treatment. Within Africa, prevention is a much more affordable, immediately affordable strategy to try to break this pandemic and bring the infection rates down.
So it's in the country's own interest, obviously, to have those cultural changes Matt describes.
Yes. And the treatment, the push for treatment has come forward in the last couple of years, and there's increasing cries for that, as you would expect, as an ever higher population of people who are HIV infected become sick mm-hmm. and become a social class that are demanding that their governments begin to bring forward some kind of care. So these governments are going to need to deal with both simultaneously. And frankly, people who agree to engage in prevention activities, who come forward to get tested and the like,
mm-hmm.
They are people who need to be convinced that should they be positive, there is some hope for them. So prevention and treatment go hand in hand.
Is financial aid here currently contingent in any aspect on changes in social behavior?
The kind of assistance that moves forward in many, many different channels.
Mm-hmm.
And I differ with the questioner's premise that somehow the leaders in Africa don't see the prevention side as the top priority. In
you
fact,
think
I think
got
they
it.
Do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, in fact, it's a pretty easy sell, and I'm not sure that it's really a question of dictating. There's lots of pressures coming out of North America and Europe to make the treatment a much bigger part of what we do, and there's good reason for doing that, so long as it doesn't gut prevention. The U.S. government's investment on HIV/AIDS, dating back to the mid-'80s, has been overwhelmingly focused on trying to promote effective prevention programs.
So there's the effort, but it's a long-term effort. Gertrude's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hello, Gertrude. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Yes. I'm from Uganda. I'm a graduate student here at University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Great.
And what I'm saying is that, you know, for so long, so many African countries pretended this did not exist and it was witchcraft and attributed it to a lot of...
They pretended that AIDS didn't even exist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And see, in Uganda, when, you know, everything was blowing up and everybody was dying,
right,
we accepted that we have a problem. You know,
and that's the first step, I suppose, to solving it or attempting it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When you never accept that you have a problem, it's like an alcoholic who's drinking so much.
Gertrude, did you see cultural social behavior change in Uganda? More monogamy, less extramarital sex, more condom usage?
Yes, I think it focused more on behavior changes in people's sexual activities, you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of enforcement from the local communities, like the tribal elders, the church members, the Catholics, Protestants, and Muslims, and of course the president himself, and they were ridiculed for having done that.
They might have been ridiculed then, but now we see that they had a big impact. Gertrude, our time is running down, but we thank you for for sharing that experience. It gives us some hope. Jack Beatty, here we are. Gertrude says it's been done in Uganda and it can be done more widely, but the clock keeps ticking.
Well, but it's so important to hear that, isn't it? I mean, you can easily get a paralysis of hope just talking about the dimension of this crisis, and that paralysis in turn can enfeeble efforts to do something about it. So we desperately need to hear that, by God, this worked there, and if it worked there, it can work elsewhere. I think that's a very important way, a note for us to strike.
It sure is. Stephen Morrison, are there other hopeful signs in the few seconds we have left here? Where are you looking for light?
Well, there's plenty of evidence of other countries than Uganda showing a major positive impacts through their leadership. In Senegal, in Thailand, in Zambia, the most recent UNAIDS report that came out at the advent of Barcelona points to Cambodia and the Philippines. Brazil is a standout case. South Africa is moving ahead at many levels right now. So I don't think that there's reason to say that Uganda is the only case. Quite the contrary.
Well, we'll say bravo to all those and look there for hope. Stephen Morrison, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Morrison is director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can continue this conversation by going to onpointradio.org and clicking on forums. In a moment, WorldCom execs come to Capitol Hill. This is On Point. Former senior management team of WorldCom was on Capitol Hill today for a hearing before the House Financial Services Committee, but lawmakers got few answers as former CEO Bernard Ebbers and former CFO Scott Sullivan refused to testify, invoking their Fifth Amendment rights. Here's former CEO Bernard Ebbers.
Although I would like, more than you know, to answer the questions that you and your colleagues have about WorldCom, I've been instructed by my counsel not to testify based on my Fifth Amendment constitutional rights. After careful consideration, I have decided to follow my counsel's instruction, even though I do not believe I have anything to hide in these or any other proceedings.
With the former executives of WorldCom refusing to testify, the committee members put the heat on other witnesses, Melvin Dick, Arthur Anderson's senior audit partner for WorldCom, and Wall Street analyst Jack Grubman, who had promoted WorldCom's stock. Here's an excerpt from Massachusetts Representative Barney Frank's questioning of Dick and Grubman at today's hearing.
The gentleman from Massachusetts, Mr. Frank.
Mr. Chairman, first, just a statement about Mr. Ebbers' statement, not about WorldCom, but about the legal profession. Your counsel did not instruct you to do anything unless you're working for him, which would be an odd relationship. Counsel may advise you. You may follow the advice or not, but people often like to blame lawyers for even more than lawyers ought to be blamed for, and they are not in a position to instruct their clients. Mr. Dick, I was somewhat struck. I'm learning, as a lot of my colleagues are, about various things, and there may be less to accounting than meets the eye. On page 2, you say, the fundamental premise of financial reporting is that the financial statements of a company are the responsibility of the company's management, not its outside auditors. Now, I hadn't thought that an either-or proposition. What you're telling me here is, in English, it's not your responsibility. Audited statements from one of the big accounting firms are not the responsibility of the outside auditors. Is that correct?
Well, the financial statements themselves and the preparation of those financial statements.
Mr. Dick, we know what we're talking about. I'm sorry, but we only have like 5 minutes. Is there no responsibility on the part of the auditing firm for the audited statements?
Well, the auditing firm's responsibility is to perform their audit in accordance with generally accepted.
Well, what do you guys do? Just check the arithmetic?
Let me
give them gold star if they edit right? I mean, this is a very minimalist function that you are describing. The notion that you have, again, I'm reading your statement, and clearly what this conveys is that you have no responsibility for those statements. The fundamental premise is that the financial statements are the responsibility of management, not its outside auditors. No responsibility on your part for the statements?
The outside auditor's responsibility is to perform an audit of those financial statements and to plan and perform that audit to...
Mr. Dick, you're not answering the question. Do you have any responsibility for the statements?
Well, those statements are prepared by management and audited by the accounting firm.
Mr. Grubman, a couple questions here. When you mentioned going to the board meetings, I was a little surprised because you said you went to those board meetings to help them with financial transactions. And that's part of the conflict that bothers me. You're an independent analyst, theoretically, but then you go to board meetings and help structure transactions, which you then later independently analyze. Does that cause you some troubles?
No, I didn't say that. What I said is on the few occasions I went to the board meeting. It was to comment on pending announcements of mergers.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure you said, we can check the translator, it was to, because you were doing transactions with them, your company.
When I say transactions, yeah. I meant merger and acquisition.
Were you advising on those?
Solomon Smith Barney.
No, you, Mr. Grubman.
No. I, as a research analyst, when I am...
I know what you are. Guys, we only got a few minutes. Let me ask you a specific question. You went to the board meeting. Your company, Solomon Smith Barney, is advising on a merger. You're there as the analyst. Who's paying you to go there to do what?
I am there only to provide the market color, the likely investor.
The market color?
The investor.
What are you, Phil Vizzuto? What does it mean, the market color? I don't understand. You do the chatter? What does that mean?
I am there, as other analysts in similar situations and other transactions, are there to provide what is the likely investor reaction to a deal that
okay,
is
so
to be
announced. Given them, but here's the problem. You've given them advice, which they should take into account, presumably. When you tell them what you think the investor reaction is going to be, that's something presumably they take into account in making decisions, correct?
It's my involvement comes at
Mr.
the
Mr. Grubman, how cautious can you be? You mean you tell them things in the assumption they're going to pay no attention whatsoever to what you do? What are you there for, lunch?
No, what I'm saying is after a transaction has already been contemplated and decided to go forward, I'm then there in a very short period when
I'm
frozen.
And you're telling me you give that information only after the final decision has been made? It's never a factor in the decision?
That is typically the
case. No, I didn't say typically. Come on, don't be so cautious. You don't answer my question. I'm asking, in any of those instances, were you giving advice before the transaction was completed?
In all three cases, right before the transactions were completed, I was asked to give investor reactions. How far before...
Which reaction you subsequently shaped or helped shape?
Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank questioning Melvin Dick, who was WorldCom's Arthur Andersen senior audit partner, and Wall Street analyst Jack Grubman today on Capitol Hill. Jack Beatty, we heard former CEO Bernie Ebbers take the fifth, and then these guys take the heat.
They sure did. I mean, would you hire either of these guys? God, what a pathetic performance. And it's great to hear that forensic swordplay from Barney Frank. I mean, it's one of the few times we've actually heard some of these principals take any pressure. But, you know, while this was going on, or shortly afterwards, President Bush at a news conference was asked about the parallel between Ebbers taking the fifth and his refusal to say more about his own, you know, alleged insider trading years ago.
He was not buying that.
He was not buying that, but the parallel was drawn. He won't talk and you won't talk, Mr. And Penny said, well, I have talked. It's been vetted. It's been looked into. And he keeps coming back to that. But the Bush performance was a very disappointing one from the point of view of investors. Again and again, questioners would say, well, isn't there a systemic problem, Mr. President, in going forward? Don't we need to make changes? And the president kept coming back to crime. He said, no, we have to hold people accountable.
Forget about the system.
Forget about the system. In other words, tomorrow's investor, well, that's too bad. We're going to it's all about bad guys. It isn't about a bad system. And I was thinking to myself, well, why is he saying this? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. He knows that. And, of course, it occurs to me, what is he going to say to a Dick Cheney? You know, Cheney was involved in this kind of thing himself.
The lines of responsibility.
It's just a very peculiar situation. And the other thing was the president was endorsing seemingly systemic change. He just wasn't connecting the questions with his own program.
Well, we'll see tomorrow morning whether or not he really rolls out some systemic change. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Okay.
It is great to hear Barney Frank imposing some plain English on the situation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...